That's just what I was going to say, Dick. You want to explain to Paul why it doesn't arc from disk to disk because of the displacement of the output connections. Because he's going to think it's building up on the disk and they're going to arc between that eighth inch.
Yeah, good point. These metal spokes, which are really flat pieces of sheet metal like tinfoil, are on the outer surfaces of these two rotating disks. Therefore, if there was going to be an arc from the forward disk to the rear disk, it would have to go through two very high voltage pieces of plastic, and it almost can't do that. Leyden jar number one and Leyden jar number two, which exist out in front of the machine, each have these great big long metallic probes. It's a metal rod about 6 inches long coming off the top of each Leyden jar. The back end of each one of these rods has got a plastic handle that allows you to bend these pivot points on the rod so you can bring the points of the rods closer together or further apart. And in my case, I can set these the gap at the end approximately 3.5 inches, and the voltage built up on the two Leyden jars will eventually arc that gap on the end of these long probes that sit out in front. So the voltage is arcing from the probes that sit out in front. And by the way, one of the fun machines you can have is something called somebody's snowstorm. I can't think of the name of the guy's name right there. Blank, blank, person, snowstorm. You've got this plastic cylinder, approximately 3 inches diameter. The plastic cylinder, 3 inches diameter, has a wall thickness of about 1/8 of an inch. The plastic cylinder is about 4 inches tall, and the axis of the plastic cylinder is vertical. There's a metal plate on the bottom of the plastic cylinder. There's a metal plate on the top of the plastic cylinder. In between is this plastic cylinder with air, just pure air in between. And you got a whole bunch of very small pitfalls inside of that airspace, inside of this clear plastic cylinder. You bring two leads from the Wimshurst machine over to those two metal plates, the one on top and bottom. And you see a very exciting thing happen. All the pitfalls sitting on the bottom, let's assume that now they pick up the positive charge because they're touching the bottom plate. Because they picked up a positive charge, these slightly conducting pitfalls, and because the bottom plate is positive, like charges repel. So the pitfalls get pushed away from the bottom plate, and because they got a positive charge on them, they get a charge, they get attracted to the upper plate. So they go flying up to the positive, the upper plate as fast as they can. They lift off, they levitate themselves off the bottom plate, and they fly up as fast as they can to the top plate. As soon as they touch the top plate, which is negatively charged, they become negatively charged and repel themselves away from the top plate and go flying back down to the bottom plate. So you've got these things bouncing back and forth as fast as they can move, and you've got about 1,000 of these little bitty pitfalls in there, and this thing makes what looks like a snowstorm, a pitfall jumping up and down as fast as they can go. Exciting thing to watch. And why can't I think of the guy's name? Some famous man's name. I'll call it Tesla's snowstorm, but it's not Tesla. That's one of the very many toys you connect to this Wimshurst machine and see some very nice science principles and yet an exciting thing to look at. Over to you for, did that description make any sense to you, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Very well explained. Now I have a good idea what we're talking about. I don't have my computer on, so I haven't looked this thing up yet. Very interesting, and continue on. I'll be listening.
Now, John, I wonder if you were at all surprised as to the price of these machines, the quality you can buy. By the way, each one of these machines that you buy, 90% of them are made in China, and they're very nicely built. You can buy the $79 one, which has got simple, some kind of particle board base with some kind of linoleum stuck to it. Or you can buy the $99 version where the base is made out of mahogany and it looks a lot classier, but it works the same. So I wonder if you were pleasantly surprised as to the quality of the machines and the number of dollars that currently exists. And from time to time, Amazon has got tremendous numbers of these things in rather high quality for very nice prices. I know that the $59 price that I paid 3 years ago, I saw those things at that price advertised 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago. All of a sudden the $59 price disappeared and looks like it was substituted with a slightly different design, very slightly different, to $79, but I'll bet you it's also Chinese made. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
I'm in from KC2FYJ.
Howie recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I was very pleasantly surprised at that price because I'm willing to pay anything under $500 for a good machine, but if I can get something in that area to toy around with it first, what I want to use it for, I have some neon tubes, like from a sign, neon sign. I have rubies and greens. They're approximately about a foot long. I'm wondering if they were connected to this machine, if they would fire, or do you think that load would be too much for it to develop? What do you think?
Yeah, your neon sign, I think, typically runs on numbers like 20 or 30 kilovolts, and this thing can turn out well over 70 or 80 kilovolts. So it will light it. I just don't know how bright and how well. You can buy from a company in Buffalo called Science First. They also sell Wimshurst machines, but they want to sell it to you for $140, and it's essentially the same machine. A little bit different in quality, $150. But they will sell you these three-inch long glass tubes that are about a quarter of an inch in diameter with metal rods coming out of each end, and you can buy them with hydrogen, argon, neon, and whatever in each one of these glass tubes, and you can put them in the vicinity or near or across the terminals of the Wimshurst machine, and you can see how each one of those gases, when they are ionized with a high voltage, what is the color that comes out of them. So it's a whole lot of things like that that you can buy. Why can't I think of the name of that guy? Somebody Snowstorm. By the way, that's the place where you buy the Snowstorm machine, from Science First. They've got a whole lot of toys that work with Wimshurst and Van de Graaff generators. Your neon sign, small pieces of neon sign will definitely light. There's enough voltage there to do it. Your biggest problem is that the Wimshurst machine can only turn out about 10 or 15 or 20 microamps max. When the humidity in the environment is low, that's the one thing that'll kill you. When I first got the machine, I'm telling you guys something that's already been told to John. Let me drop. I first received the machine on a cold winter day. That night, I operated it in my backyard. And in the backyard, in the dark, it worked like a charm. I saw all kinds of arcing and sparking and whatever. I was having a grand old time. I brought the thing into the house, and it absolutely positively stopped working, no matter what I did. I couldn't get it to go at all. It was dead. I said, what in the world did I do to do that? I brought it back outside, and after about 10 minutes outside, it started working again. And I brought it back in the house, and it stopped working. I soon figured out what's going on. The cold machine in the winter day outside, when I brought it into the house, which has got the reasonable humidity, but a lot higher than outside, and warm air, and the portions of the machine were cold, a small amount of condensation took place on the plastic discs and on the Leyden jar and whatever. A tiny bit of condensation that I could just barely see with a magnifying glass completely shorted the machine out, and the bootstrapping operation absolutely stopped. So it needs very clean discs with no fingerprints and very dry environment to get full performance. There were times when I had a reasonably dry environment, and for reasons I don't understand, the thing wouldn't start. And how do you prime the pump? I took the machine, and I bent one of the leads out from one of the Leyden jars, what I wanted it to be, the positive lead. I bent it out a little bit, and I brought the machine over to the front glass of my cathode ray tube television set and touched it to the television set. It picked up enough voltage, primed the pump, and after that, it ran like a charm. Over to you, Harry. KC2FYJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Not sure if the Wimshurst page that I'm looking at is the one that you were talking about, but it looks like it probably is, and there's a link on it to Edmund Scientific where they say it's for sale for $120, $119.95.
Yep.
It actually turns into shop.com, but that's what where the link goes from that page. And it is the big red discs, and it is the page that had the description of that you were making of the third diagram, so I think it's the same place.
About 15 years ago is the very first Wimshurst machine I bought from Edmund Scientific. And in those days, I think it was like $75 15 years ago. That particular machine was very low in performance. I'll be amazed if that thing made 20 kilovolts, 30 kilovolts, absolute max. Very low performance machine then. Now, maybe Edmund has a much better machine. Edmund has some pretty nice stuff, but their prices tend to be a little bit on the high side. The Amazon.com place in Wimshurst will give you a lot more bang for the dollar, in my opinion. Another point I was going to make.
75,000 volts, 15 inches tall.
Okay. And they won $130 or $150, and you don't have to pay that much. Another thing I tried doing, because I had two machines, I said, hey, I'm going to put the two machines in series. If one machine will turn out conservatively 100 kilovolts, and the second one will turn out 100 kilovolts, and I connect them in series, and I turn both cranks simultaneously, I'm going to get 200 and some odd kilovolts, is what I said. Good plan. Absolutely not. you put them in series, you've now got a lot of exposed hardware at high voltage. Mother Nature comes along and finds some way of killing that few microamps the thing can turn out, and you get very little voltage when you put them in series. Put them in parallel. Now you're doubling the current rate at which you're charging the Leyden jars, and you've got twice as much charge, and you get much more exciting sparks. Also, from Science First, you can buy these metal can type things that are called Leyden jar. It's got a great big hook on the top, a metal hook with a metal ball on the end of that, and this is a disassemblable Leyden jar. You connect one of those Leyden jars across the Leyden jar that's in the Wimshurst machine, and you're doubling the total amount of capacitance that's present. I took a pair of those devices from Science First, connected them across each one of the Leyden jars of my Wimshurst machine. It takes twice as long to charge the thing, but when it finally gives a spark, whoa, that's a whopper. You get a nice loud one. You don't get more voltage, because eventually you arc over the gap that's in the Leyden jar that you bought from Science First. It's not as well shielded as the Leyden jar that's in the Wimshurst machine, but you can get a very healthy spark. You got to be a little bit careful now. You've got to calculate the number of joules of charge that you're capable of putting in your particular apparatus. And if from left hand to right hand, you discharge that number of joules through you. You might be approaching the point where a human being, in the worst case timing, could become fibrillated. So you've got to be a little bit on the careful side. These machines, as manufactured, are guaranteed to be safe. You start making the modifications that I'm talking about, you better be careful. Anybody with any further questions about these circuits and how they work and what you can do with them and whatever, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Question on the neon.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, if the neon tube is attached initially, do you think that the machine will still build up a charge, or do you think that the neon will drip, won't allow it to build up a charge?
If the leakage within your neon tube is too great that it won't allow it to start, there's a very simple procedure you can get around that. Create a small gap on one of the ends of the neon tube to one of the probes. Let it build up voltage across that gap, and then let it to arc to that gap, or then bring the gap close. The way the machine works, its bootstrapping action is such that in the beginning, when the voltage across your capacitor is small, across your Leyden jar is small, it builds up voltage very slowly. As you continue to turn the crank, and as the voltage on the Leyden jars builds up, the thing starts turning out more current, the voltage rises at a higher rate, and so the only part that's really spooky is startup. Once you've got it started, the machine will turn out 10 or 20 microamps and charge its capacitors very nicely. So by creating the gap, you can get around that problem. You just have to make sure that during the starting procedure, everything is super clean and dry. Otherwise, you might not get a startup. And if you can't get a startup, as I told you, there's ways of priming the pump to force that. I remember one particular summer day where the humidity wasn't super high. No matter what I did, by wiping Kleenexes across the metal spokes to make sure everything was clean and dry and whatever, I just couldn't get the machine to dry to start until I discovered the technique of bringing one probe over to the forward piece of glass on the cathode ray tube of an upper rating television set. That did it. That primed the pump, and after that it ran like a charm. Each time you get a spark discharge across the probes, common sense would lead you to believe that you're thoroughly discharging the Leyden jars. Absolutely not. The Leyden jars might have, let me pick a number, 125 kilovolts at the beginning. The spark takes place. It jumps 2.5 inches. You get a nice loud report. You see a nice purple flash. And you assume the voltage on your Leyden jars is now zero. It goes down to some low number, like maybe 10 kilovolts. And it starts right up there immediately again. Usually, once you start the machine with the left-hand probe positive and the right-hand probe negative, it'll stay that polarity continuously. But there's a catch. When you look at these diagrams of this Red Windhurst machine in operation on that website entitled Multi-Spark Gap Experiment, and you look down at the bottom where you've got those oscilloscope pictures, there's something very classic going on in those pictures. I'm looking at one. I'm paging down to it right now. There it is. Each one of those pictures, you see a funny rise in the baseline as the thing is being charged. You see the great big vertical spike as the discharge takes place. Because you're discharging across an inductor, the magic of an inductor is that when you charge the inductor and let go of it, the area under the curve during the charging and the area under the curve during the discharging must be the same area. When you look at each one of those plots, you'll rapidly discover that the area under the curve, between 0 volts and the curve to the right of the discharge, is a much bigger area. On top of that, the discharge phenomena on the right-hand side does not come to baseline the way it should. What's really happening on that experiment is that ferrite rod with the 90 turns of coil on it, that's across the Windhurst machine, with or without the spark gap, that device is really across the Leyden jars. As such, during that discharge and inductive kickback, your Leyden jars are being charged in the opposite polarity. Therefore, the continuing rotation of the handle on the Windhurst machine is now operating the Windhurst machine in the opposite polarity. The machine itself doesn't give a darn whether you want it to run with the right-hand probe positive or the right-hand probe negative. Until you do something to reverse the procedure, so to speak, it'll continue to run for the rest of the day in that polarity. But you thoroughly discharge it to ground, there's a 50-50 chance it'll start up at the opposite polarity. Or if you do something to reverse the polarity on the Leyden jars, the next time you turn the crank, it'll charge itself with opposite polarity. The thing doesn't favor any one particular polarity. I wonder if you noticed that on those oscilloscope pictures, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, I did notice that on those waveforms. Also, I was thinking of priming it with my glass rod and cat's fur, and this way I could prime it the same way each time. That should work, no?
I agree. Your cat's fur and glass rod has a very specific polarity, and therefore you can choose which is the positive lead. And when you finally find out which is the positive lead, when you find out how to adjust the probes so that the positive lead is pointing toward the middle of the negative probe, you'll get the biggest spark, the highest voltage, the most operation of the machine. If you do the opposite, you move the two probes with your plastic handles such that the negative lead is now pointing toward the middle of the positive probe, because of the way the E-field forms around that pointy probe that's doing the pointing, gives you a higher local E-field, and because the negative electrons are so much more mobile, probably 1,000 times more mobile than the positive charges, what you'll get instead is a whole bunch of sizzling taking place at the negative lead. The thing will continuously discharge itself. You'll never build up a high voltage. You'll never get a real spark. Also, on the machines that I bought, which I think are the same as the ones I showed you that you can buy from Amazon.com, the two Leyden jars are connected together with a metal strip that's got two little screw-down caps. You loosen up the screw-down caps, you move the metal strip out of the way, and now the two bottom leads, the grounding leads of the Leyden jars, are no longer connected together. you're no longer charging the Leyden jars in the same manner. So now when you bring the two probes close enough together, you turn the crank, and you're generating high voltage, you see a very different phenomenon. The spark you get now is, of course, extremely quiet by comparison, extremely weak-looking by comparison, but it's got a couple of other very crazy characteristics. The spark in the vicinity of the positive lead always shows a gap. In other words, repeater, timeout, cancel. You'll see a spark between the two leads. The spark now no longer has the normal zigzag characteristic to it. It's almost always a straight spark, much smaller distance of spark. And if the spark was, let me pick a number, 3/4 inch long or 1/2 inch long, near the positive lead, you'll see the spark going across, particularly in a dark room. It's a moderately bright spark, but the spark never completely touches the negative lead. There's always a 1/16 inch or 1/8 inch gap. How in the world does it make a spark but always leave a gap? I don't know. There's a bunch of mysteries there as to what's going on. But the machine behaves quite differently without the backup capacitance of the Leyden jars. I'm guessing part of what goes on is that, just like with real lightning begins with what's called leaders. In other words, and you'll notice that every lightning bolt that you've ever seen out in Mother Nature is almost always completely zigzagged. And each of those zigzags, on average, are roughly 120 feet long, 30 or 40 meters long. And that's because the voltage on the cloud, 99% of the time, is nowhere near high enough to reach from the cloud to the ground at 30 kilovolts per centimeter. Air has a dielectric strength of 30 kilovolts per centimeter. The cloud might be a couple of miles high. You'd need many megavolts and maybe gigavolts on the cloud in order to arc that gap. The cloud is heavily charged, but never that high. The cloud is probably 10-1, maybe 100-1 shy of the right amount of voltage to arc from cloud to ground. And yet it does it. Let me drop. What happens is some of those electrons on the bottom of the cloud, for whatever reason, repel each other and say, I'm out of here. And they've got enough voltage to arc the air in front of them for the first 120 feet. And they create a channel 120 feet long, a very lightly charged, a very light current channel. It's called a leader. It's not a real lightning bolt, 120 feet long. Along comes another cosmic ray that connects that particular channel, and it arcs the next 120 feet and sits there and waits until another cosmic ray comes along. Each one of these cosmic rays are nanoseconds or microseconds apart. When you take photographs of lightning bolts, you'll see that they're always zigzagged. Most of the time, they look like an upside-down tree. There's multiple, there's a branch, there's a trunk coming out of the cloud, and multiple branches from there down toward the ground. And sometimes some of those branches don't make it because the right cosmic ray didn't come along at the right time, whereas an adjacent branch does make it, so to speak. So each one of these zigzags that you get out of the Wimshurst machine when you've got the Leyden jars in operation is the leader stroke being backed up by the charge on that Leyden jar capacitor. Put some real current into that first little step, and then another cosmic ray comes along. It gives you some strong evidence of the zillions of cosmic rays that are hitting you at every second, obvious by the fact that each one of your spark gaps on your Wimshurst machine will be a zigzag. And I'm reasonably convinced that all of those zigzags could be due to cosmic rays. That's one explanation. The other explanation is that an electron gets accelerated to a high enough velocity that when it strikes the next air molecule and ionizes it, it becomes sort of like a billiard ball shot, and therefore, because it doesn't hit it straight on, it becomes a glancing blow, and the ionized ball after the impact goes off in some crazy direction. So is it a multiple pool shot-like zigzag on the spark you get on the Wimshurst machine? Or is it cosmic rays, or is it a combination of the two? Right now, I don't know. And as you study this, eventually we're going to find out, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And take you in with it. KC2WGB. I'll probably order my machine tonight. Two questions, Nick. Most of the Wimshurst machines I see on the electrodes have two spherical balls. Now, you said you're pointing one to the other now. Are you saying one should be pointed elements and one should be spherical? And the next question is, the space between the arc and the negative element, could that be a space charge snuffing it? We use arc snuffers. Could that be the reason that you noticed that gap?
I don't have a good explanation for the gap. I can tell by the portion of the spark that's across 90% of the total gap between the two probes that real current is flowing. And how is current flowing through the area that does not show any lighting? I don't have a good explanation for that one. So I don't know what's going on there. Now, each one of the probes coming out of the machine are, something in the vicinity of 6 inches long. It's a 6-inch long rod with a pair of metallic balls on the end, a large metallic ball and a small metallic ball sitting on top of that. Each one of the probes looks like that. And the far end of this probe has got a plastic handle that you can operate, which allows you to position the probes so that you can make the two probes close together or far apart. If you bring them the closest together so that they touch, they will each be something close to 45 degrees from vertical. In other words, the left-hand one will be tilted 45 degrees to the right, the right-hand one will be tilted 45 degrees to the left, and the pairs of metallic balls at the ends are touching each other. You've now made a gap of zero. If you now take the left-hand one and rotate it from 45 degrees to the right, so that it's now only 30 degrees to the right from vertical, and you take the left-hand and the right-hand one and bend it so that now it's not 45 degrees to the left, it's now 55 degrees to the left or 60 degrees to the left. You've now got the two balls on the right-hand probe aimed at the middle of the shaft of the left-hand probe. When you do that, assuming the right-hand probe, which is pointing toward the shaft of the left-hand probe, if the right-hand probe is positive, you'll get a nice, beautiful spark in that manner. As far as the E-field lines that you could draw around that right-hand probe, right at the right-hand probe double ball tip, you've got an extremely small, or extremely large E-field with parabolic curved lines around that object that become much flatter equipotential lines as you approach the shaft of the left-hand probe. So, right-hand probe positive, very strong E-field at the right-hand probe, but because of the low mobility of the positive charges, it won't leak off, it won't make this fuzzy sound, and you'll build up a nice charge and you'll get a nice spark. If correspondingly the right-hand probe in that experiment I just described has the negative charge, the negative electrons are so mobile that when they sense that they are on the end of a probe where there's a large local E-field, they start fizzling off as a corona discharge. They discharge themselves. They keep continuously discharging the machine before it ever gets a chance to build up a high voltage, and you never get a spark. So you're not changing the probes in any way. You're just deciding how to position them. And most of the U-tube articles, the people using the machine, never made this discovery. Of all the Wimshurst articles that I read over the last few years, just one of them describes this particular phenomenon. And once you learn it, it allows you to get a lot more performance out of the machine. I wonder if that made some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The KC2, QIQ with a comment?
John first. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, it does. It makes a lot of sense, and I understand exactly what you're talking about those positions. And I'll work on that. I think I'm going to have a lot of fun with that machine. Now that I'm not worried so much about my equipment, and maybe I'll put shorting connectors on the real sensitive stuff just to make sure, especially initially, because I'm very interested in these experiments I'm going to do with the neon gas. Back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, apparently you've been working with, making some, strong sparks across a fairly good-sized gap. I was just wondering if you have ever tried the experiments by blowing a fan, taking a fan where you can actually control the airspeed across the gap while you're creating a good strong arc across it, and seeing some of the effects of that. Back to the K2RW, KC2QIQ.
The way you're describing it, if I had a Jacob's ladder and I blew a fan across it, I'd see a lot of effect. But the Jacob's ladder is an AC machine with a continuous arc. This Wimshurst machine, you turn the crank and 4 seconds later, you build up enough voltage that you get a spark across a gap that could be 3.5 inches. 3 5/8 is the biggest gap that I've ever jumped periodically, cyclically. When the machine is really clean, the room is dry, and everything's working just right, I can jump 3 5/8 inches. And you got to measure that with a plastic ruler. Don't measure that with a metal ruler. You'll be unhappy. When the machine, you turn the crank, and 3, 4, 5 seconds later, you get a snap. You get a real loud, bright, zigzaggy spark across that 3.5-inch gap. That spark probably lasts for, let me pick a number, 5 microseconds. And that spark is quite intense. I haven't done the fan experiment, but it is my guess that the fan in that experiment might not make any difference. Or the possibility exists that because the fan is blowing air across the probes, that the spark never happens in the first place, that you're blowing away the leaders. In many cases, I have detected the faint sound of leaders that don't quite make it. You're turning the crank on the machine, you've got the gap set a little bit too far, and you hear tick, 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 tick. In other words, the machine is trying to arc the gap, but can't get quite enough high enough voltage to ionize the whole path. That's what happens when you set the gap a little bit too much for the dryness of that particular day. And one of the experiments that I'm in the process of doing is building a pair of these discs that are twice the diameter. And I'm going to install them in the machine. And what really limits the highest voltage you can get is the diameter of the disc. Once everything is working right, the diameter of the disc.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The diameter of the disc that are being rotated limits the maximum voltage the machine can generate. If you operate it in a dark room, you'll soon see why. And that is, in a dark room, when you're at the maximum operating voltage, you'll see a minor amount of coronal discharge taking place between the spokes on each rotating disc. Between those spokes, you've got some pretty high voltages. And pretty soon, the coronal discharge between the spokes is the limit on the machine. As you build the disc larger in diameter, and either have a larger number of spokes or larger gaps between the spokes, depending on how you set it up, you now can go to a higher voltage. So twice the diameter of the discs, in theory, can give you twice the voltage before the machine goes into a self-limiting function. You got to be a little bit careful when you do that. You got to worry about whether or not your Leyden jars are built correctly to tolerate the higher voltage. And now, because you're doubling the voltage, which by 1/2 CV², you're quadrupling the stored energy in joules, you're now approaching the point where you could do damage to a human being in the worst-case scenario. KC2WGB, you got to own one of these things, Glenn. I don't know how you've lived without it. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Glenn.
No, by the time I have another question.
Yeah, I've never owned the Wilmhurst machine. I've seen them operated in a couple of different times. Very amazing. But I've actually come across, you know, this, you know, the sparks and putting the fan across it. And what's fascinating, at least from what I was able to observe, is that if you can get the sparks to take place across the gap relatively consistently, so you can get them to take place one right after another, or use an AC source like you were mentioning before, where you can actually create almost a continuous arc, and you put a fan actually in between the arc, yes, it definitely takes more energy to create the spark, but generally once it's going, you can get the fan. You don't want to put it too close, like you said, otherwise you can actually extinguish the spark altogether, or the arc. But you can actually shape it with the fan just by blowing the air pressure across and actually get the arc to move well outside the gap and around the outside. It's quite interesting. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And what that proves is that what is really breaking down, what's making the arc, is you are ionizing the air molecules. And so when the air molecules are moving in a particular direction, the arc gets bent in that direction, as if you're applying a force to the arc, so to speak. Your power companies on your extremely high voltage power transmission system use this phenomenon. When they open up a fuse of a 300 kilovolt line, open up a circuit breaker, so to speak, that line, which goes for, let me pick a number, you know, 300 miles, has a huge amount of inductance because of the length of that wire. As such, you open up that circuit breaker, you get an inductive kickback that even though you've opened the circuit breaker 5 feet, that arc will simply jump the 5 foot bend, 5 foot gap, and keep right on arcing. You think you've opened up the circuit breaker. You go to the right YouTube video, and you can see some of these exciting projects where somebody opens up one of these 300 kilovolt, 500 kilovolt lines, three phases, and all three phases are arcing. And the guy is screaming, look at that. Honey drop. Now, in order to use the phenomena that you just described, and because it really is the air that's doing the ionizing, that's sustaining the arc, in a vacuum, nothing would happen. In a pure vacuum, you open up that circuit breaker, and as long as there's a 16th of an inch of a gap, even though you got a 300 kilovolt line, no current would flow if it was a perfect vacuum. And if you had the right kind of materials that have a high multi-pactor phenomena, that's another whole issue. But what they really got in these circuit breakers on the high kilovolt, extremely high voltage lines, is there is a local compressed source of, I think it's usually sulfur hexafluoride, dry nitrogen, I'm not sure what it is. But it's a timed sequence where if you've given the command to open that circuit breaker, the circuit breaker arm lifts as far as it wants to, which maybe is going from the horizontal position to the vertical position, and now there's a, let me pick a number, a 4 foot gap there. And at the instant the 4 foot gap is present and arcing, the time sequence is such that now the compressed gas is blown into that gap in order to extinguish it. And if for some reason the timing is not right, or the compressed gas is not properly charged, and you don't blow out that gap, after that you're in a fair amount of trouble because you've run out of options. If Mother Nature feels like continuing to arc that gap, you're going to be burning up an awful lot of power. I wonder if you've seen that particular YouTube, Glenn. Over to you, Glenn, for a quick one on that one, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was that one in particular, but I've seen a lot of those a lot of those kinds of little movies of those arcs. When you're opening up high voltage lines with high power and current, especially with inductive loads. And yeah, it's quite spectacular, Dick. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment, Dick?
Wesley was going to first and then John in that order. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, take John comment. I have a question about standing wave and another question.
You got it, John.
You're right, Dick, about the gas and the switching. Most of those switches on the high voltage are a piston-type switch that are confined in a cylinder, which is charged with that gas, and it's a very quick pull-away, and the gas is the snuffer, and the voltage determines, of course, the length of that solenoid switch. Very effective, and it works well. Used on a lot of high-voltage stuff.
In some cases, I think they use a very specific gas. It could be sulfur hexafluoride. It could be dry nitrogen. Is it compressed air, or is there a specific gas that they use in those extremely high-voltage interrupter circuits? Over to you, John.
No, you're right. It's a sulfide gas, SF6, and it's very effective. And when it, they have pressure switches on those switches, that if that gas is evacuated and there's no pressure in there, that switch will not function. So it is because the switch will just explode, just like you said, because nothing's going to stop that arc.
Now, let's assume, John, I'm going to ask you a question, which is a little bit of a puzzle, but it illustrates something very good. Air breaks down at roughly 30 kilovolts per centimeter. So I've got two rounded probes in my test fixture that are exactly 1 centimeter apart. I've got some kind of a high voltage power supply. I turn the knob on the power supply, and as I approach 30 kilovolts, an arc takes place between those two probes. And I'm reconfirming that air's dielectric strength is 30 kilovolts per centimeter, two probes a centimeter apart. I now put the two of those probes inside of a bell jar, and I'm not going to pump a vacuum. I'm going to pump pressure. I'm going to put ordinary dry air from the room into that bell jar, and I'm going to make the atmosphere in the bell jar twice as high. I'm going to go to two atmospheres instead of one atmosphere, which really means that each of the air molecules in that bell jar are now half the distance apart. I've doubled the air pressure. I've got twice the number of air molecules in that bell jar as I would have if I was at one atmosphere. I'm at two atmosphere, and take my word for it, each of the air molecules are now half the spacing they had before. And I again repeat the experiment. I turn up the power supply until an arc takes place. Q give me a guess at what voltage it'll now arc over. It used to arc over at 30 kilovolts with two atmospheres. What do you guess will happen? Over to you, John.
Probably 45 to 60 kilovolts.
In other words, with the air molecules packed closer together, the air now has a higher dielectric strength. You do realize that that's opposite of common sense. That's obvious why I'm asking the question. And do you know the explanation for why that happens that way?
Not really, Dick. I don't think I know the exact reason. But I know that the higher the pressure, the higher the arc over voltage.
You're absolutely right. And if you go to the right website and you ask for the Paschen curve, P-A-S-C-H-E-N, Mr. Paschen, way back around 1900 or so.
Is that the bathtub curve?
That's the bathtub curve. Mr. Paschen discovered that when he used his bell jar and he pulled a vacuum, as he pulled the vacuum, and he went to lower and lower amounts of air pressure, the air broke down sooner and sooner. 30 kilovolts per centimeter at one atmosphere, at half an atmosphere, maybe it takes 20 kilovolts per centimeter instead of 30. Much lower voltage, it'll arc over the same gap. As he goes to, something like 80,000 feet, I guess now you're down to like 5% of the atmospheric pressure. Instead of 20 kilovolts, it goes down to like 5 kilovolts. The air will arc over at very low voltages as you go to a partial vacuum. Now, as you continue to pull a vacuum in that bell jar, and now you get harder and harder vacuum, all of a sudden the curve starts climbing back up again. And when you make the vacuum in the jar perfect, you can't make an arc happen at all. Any idea why air behaves that crazy curve? Anybody got a guess on this one? K2RIW in the TechNet? Yeah, apparently I got a new one on you guys. I did explain this once before, about a year ago. What really happens when you got high voltage on two probes that are close to each other? In general, nothing happens. Along comes a cosmic ray that decides to ionize a particular air molecule. Ionize means that the cosmic ray hit the air molecule with enough energy that at least one electron got pulled away from that air molecule. Maybe the air molecule was oxygen, maybe it was argon, maybe it was nitrogen, doesn't matter. A particular air molecule has just become ionized, which means at least one electron was pulled away from that air molecule's structure. So now you've got a positively charged air ion molecule, because he's lacking one electron, and you've got a free electron. That free electron is by far the most mobile, by 1,000 to 1. That free electron says, whoa, over to my right, I've got a negatively charged terminal. I don't like that one. Like charges repel. I'm pushing away from that one. To my left side, I've got a positively charged electrode. Oh, I like that one. Opposite charges retract. So with all due speed, that electron starts moving to the left toward the positive electrode as fast as he possibly can. And the rate at which he accelerates, you know his mass, you know his charge, you know the E field you've created, you know the volts per centimeter, so to speak. So therefore, you know the rate of change of electric potential versus distance, you know his mass, you know his charge. Faraday's law, you know exactly how to calculate how much force of electrostatic attraction has been applied to that particular electron. Let me drop. Therefore, if you care enough, you can calculate exactly what rate of acceleration he is experiencing. So he is continuously accelerating because he's sensing this continuous force field of the electrostatic potential difference between those two probes. He's in the middle of the two probes, and he's a free charged electron, and boy, he's starting to move. On average, his air molecules are, I think, roughly three nanometers apart. If I looked at all of those air molecules, on average, they're three nanometers apart from each other, on average. And the mean free path between them, because the air molecules themselves are very small, 3 nanometers sounds like a small number, but each one of them is about an angstrom in diameter, 0.1 nanometer in diameter, but 3 nanometers between them. So there's a 30 to 1 ratio of the diameter versus the spacing of the air molecules. Therefore, when that electron moves, there's a high probability he's not going to hit anything. He's going to be running between the raindrops, so to speak. on average, the mean free path is 63 nanometers. So that electron continuously accelerates, and he moves 63 nanometers. On average, after he's moved 63 nanometers, he's going to strike another air molecule. If he was moving fast enough, he strikes the next air molecule with enough force to ionize it, and he starts an avalanche. If there wasn't a high enough voltage potential, he doesn't get a chance to move fast enough. He strikes the next air molecule. He strikes it with too little energy, and nothing happens. And the whole process essentially stops. He eventually finds a free positive molecule somewhere, and he rejoins it, and the event is over. So at each air pressure, there's a specific number of volts per centimeter, which will allow a free...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
For each amount of air pressure, there's an amount of volts per centimeter that will allow a free electron to accelerate fast enough that on average at 63 nanometers of mean free path, he's going to strike another air molecule with enough energy that he can really ionize it and do something, start the avalanche. Along comes Dick with his experiment, with his bell jar, and he doubles the air pressure in the bell jar. So instead of those air molecules being 3 nanometers apart, they're 1.5 nanometers apart. The mean free path is no longer 63 nanometers, it's now 31 nanometers. Because the path, mean free path, is shorter, now when that exact same voltage accelerates that exact same electron, he doesn't get a chance to move far enough to accelerate enough to get up enough speed to hit the next air molecule. So you have to double the voltage in order to do that. That's why higher air pressure requires more voltage, because you don't have enough space for the electrons to get accelerated to do their thing when they strike the next air molecule.
Instead, when the temperature increases, which is actually the motion.
Okay. One of those strange things about air dielectric strength is as a function of humidity, almost nothing happens. As a function of air temperature, nothing happens, but there's a catch. If I heat up air that is completely free to flow out of the bell jar, the hotter air will expand. Some of the air will flow out of the bell jar. Now the mean free space has increased, and it'll break down at a lower voltage. Hotter air, completely free, will break down at a lower voltage. However, if I've got 1 atmosphere of air in the bell jar, for instance, and I close off the vent so that the air cannot move, and now I heat up the air pressure in there increases, but the total number of molecules doesn't change. The total spacing between the molecules doesn't change. So if I close off the vent first, then heat up the air, the breakdown voltage will stay essentially unchanged. Do you see that principle, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Absolutely, Dick. I was just wondering how that would affect it, because now the motion of the electrons are increased, but again, the spacing is basically staying the same. Is that correct?
You said motion of the electrons. You really meant motion of the air. The hotter air molecules in the sealed container will move faster. That's what temperature is, average kinetic energy. So the air molecules are moving faster, but the velocity of the air molecules, which on average is 500 meters per second, is slow as all hell compared to the velocity of that electron. So that's a very minor effect. The electron itself, once he has been ionized by a cosmic ray that came along, and he's in the presence of an E field, he accelerates real fast. He's got a huge charge. He's got an extremely small amount of mass, and he moves. Man, that's an extremely high power-to-weight ratio vehicle, if you know what I mean. So the E field voltage determines 99.9% how fast that electron moves. The local temperature of the air molecules is a very minor effect by comparison. Those air molecules are moving super slow compared to that electron. That's my guess on that one. Over to you, John.
Well, it sounds like it's a congruent effect. Very good. Well, thanks for that explanation, Dick. Back to you.
Those who've tuned in late, we're discussing high voltage circuits, breakdown of air, Wimshurst machine, spark gaps, and all of the above. Anybody any further questions tonight before we leave this subject, Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, you guys have had enough of that one. We'll pick it up again next week. Wesley, you had a question on standing wave ratio. One of my favorite subjects. I'm the guy who owns a couple of patents on how to design antennas that across a 3% bandwidth of a high-gain antenna can have a VSWR that does not exceed 1.05 minus 30 dB reflection coefficient. So I think I've got an understanding of VSWR, but that's an opinion. N2XJM, K2RIW.
N2XJM. Basically, my question was, I had two of them. One was the standing wave ratio. I mean, not wave ratio, standing wave. When you have a coaxial cable at a given length, and then you have a mismatch of the impedance at the end, at a certain point of the coaxial cable, you have a hot spot. My assumption would be that you can take a reading from outside of the coax cable close to the insulation, and you would be able to detect this hot spot. I wonder how this hot spot looks like. If we have a shape of the sinusoidal signal, is it that concentration going to be like deformation of that sine wave in this particle? Point it would be more saturated. I'm trying to visualize it. That's one question. And the second one would be, what is the saturation of the inductor, and how would you picture that?
Now, if I was living in Santiago, Chile, and I walked into the local electronics store, as a good buddy of mine has done, and I buy coaxial cable, the braided flexible coaxial cable I can buy in Santiago was made by Brand X, and the amount of braid coverage is very little. In other words, if I strip away the outer black plastic jacket and I look at that braid, the braid is probably covering up 50% of the cable, and there's air gaps in between. That's a very leaky piece of cable. And I can make all kinds of funny measurements with leaky cable. So let me flip over to making your coaxial cable out of hardline. The outer jacket is a solid piece of copper tubing. Center conductor is whatever you like it to be. And let's make air dielectric in between. And now let's make my load a thoroughly shielded load. In other words, I've got a good connector on the end of the cable. My load is inside of a black box. I've got a good connector on the outside of the box. And the connector is well grounded to the metal of the box. And inside of the box, I've got a poor load. It's a 25-ohm resistor, a 100-ohm resistor. It's got some stray capacitance, some stray inductance. I've got a lousy load inside the box. And so the signal that goes down, that 50-ohm piece of hardline, goes into that box, sees that dummy load, sees that yucky load, and a significant amount of energy flows back on that cable. That's what you and I call standing wave ratio. It has a certain voltage reflection ratio, depending on how bad that load is. But it's a thoroughly shielded load. Now, my first question to you, so that you and I can understand where we're coming from, is in that environment, I'm running that transmitter continuously. The end of the cable is continuously seeing a shielded, poor load, and energy is reflecting. Now, at the so-called hot spots on the cable, on the outside of that cable, you're going to put some kind of instrumentation to
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You're going to put some kind of instrumentation to locate the locations of those hot spots. Wesley, tell me what kind of instrumentation you're going to use on the outside of that hard line to locate those hot spots. Over to you, Wes.
By definition, the best one would be the temperature meter. As far as the electric signal, it would be none. Nothing outside. We have a tubing, there is nothing outside. As far as the electromagnetic field or magnetic field, well, I should see a presence of the magnetic field outside. And to exit.
And you gave me three answers. And the first two answers are right on. Give that man a cigar. Correct. The third answer I disagree with. Yes, there's some strong magnetic field taking place inside that cable. But if I'm operating at a high enough frequency where the skin depth of that outer copper, outer conductor of that coax cable, where the skin depth is many skin depths thick, even though there's a huge magnetic field that might be on the inside of that cable, in that environment I just described, none of it gets outside. The magnetic field, the electric field, no RF energy of any kind gets out of that particular hardline cable if I've done it right. In your first answer, you're absolutely right. I will find the hot spots. You said with a temperature indicator, a thermometer, I would do it with a thermal imaging camera. The next question is, the hot spots that I see with a thermal imaging camera that happen every half wave approximately, are they the spots where the current is maximum or the voltage is maximum?
Current is maximum.
No. It's not current maximum and it's not voltage maximum. You want to give another answer?
You lost me in here. Just a moment. Hold on. Current times voltage equals power. The factor that creates a power dissipation to the temperature. Okay, so that would be current times voltage would be power. Enter XGN.
Yeah, now you've got to have more information to give the right answer. If I was using polyethylene coax cable, and I was doing the experiment at 2 gigahertz, where the loss tangent of the polyethylene is significant, now the polyethylene is going to give me the greatest amount of heating of the dielectric material in the places where the voltage is maximum. So with polyethylene cable as a dielectric, the voltage maximum points are going to be a place where I see the greatest amount of heat because I'm getting dielectric heating of the dielectric. What is it called? That loss tangent type stuff. If I had air-filled cable where there is no dielectric in there, air or vacuum, now the current maximum points are where the copper center conductor is doing the most amount of heating. So the hot spots will be at the current maximums with air cable, and at a high enough frequency, the temperature maximums are going to be at the voltage maximum with polyethylene cable. Your next question is, what happens if I take polyethylene cable, slowly go down in frequency where the polyethylene becomes lower and lower in loss? Can I get to a point where the amount of heating due to current on the center conductor and the amount of heating due to high voltage on the dielectric are equal to each other? And the answer is yes. You choose the right frequency with polyethylene cable, and it will not have hot spots. It'll be uniform hot along the whole length of the cable. Into XJN, you probably got a comment on this one. K2RIW in the DECnet.
Well, at first we have to differentiate between the standing wave between a certain point and the standing wave equally feeding the coax. And at a certain frequency and at a certain mismatch of the impedance, you would have a coax that would be equally hot. Yes, I agree with that.
Okay, now let's go to the next step with our standing wave ratio. I could do it with pulses. So if I take my guy wire on my 100-foot tower, and the guy wire is about 150 feet long, and I stand on the ground and I sight my eye along the guy wire, and I tap the guy wire with my fist, and I see a pulse move down that guy wire, up that guy wire, and at the end of the guy wire that's connected to the tower, it thinks it's a short circuit. So my positive going pulse goes up the guy wire, hits the tower. Because the tower is lower in impedance than the guy wire, it's a short circuit, the pulse reverses in polarity, bounces off the tower, and starts coming back down toward me. So I sent up a positive pulse, it hits the short circuit at the end, comes back as a negative pulse, and comes down to me. That's a pulse requirement. That's a pulse experiment of a reflective transmission line. If I wanted to, I continuously tap the guy wire with my fist, and I make a continuous, almost sine wave if I do it just right. So I got a bunch of sine waves going up the tower. By the way, let me backtrack one step. While I tapped the guy wire once and a pulse went up, reversed the polarity and started coming back to me, before the pulse got all the way back to me, I hit the guy wire again. I now have a second positive pulse going up the guy wire. I have the negative pulse coming back down from the tower toward me. When the two hit in the middle,